Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Are you scouring the web for the best Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals? Stop it. Get Rakuten. Rakuten is a shopping sidekick that gets you cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. Right now, you can get up to 15% cash back at the stores you love. You can even stack cash back on top of the biggest sales of the year. That's savings on savings. It's more time shopping and less time searching. With Rakuten, you're always saving at your favorite stores on the things you're already buying. Cash back is automatically added to your account as you shop, and you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. It's truly a no-brainer. Now's the time to join. Up to 15% cash back ends on 12/2. Plus, new members will receive a welcome bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Are you scouring the web for the best Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals? Stop it. Get Rakuten. Rakuten is a shopping sidekick that gets you cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. Right now, you can get up to 15% cash back at the stores you love. You can even stack cash back on top of the biggest sales of the year. That's savings on savings. It's more time shopping and less time searching. With Rakuten, you're always saving at your favorite stores on the things you're already buying. Cash back is automatically added to your account as you shop, and you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. It's truly a no-brainer. Now's the time to join. Up to 15% cash back ends on 12/2. Plus, new members will receive a welcome bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers Year in Review, a look back at the biggest stories of 2025. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
So, the ex-wife of the alleged Gilgo Beach serial killer, she just watched a Netflix docu-series, allegedly, and now she's allegedly wondering if her former husband is a fall guy in one of the most disturbing serial killer cases in recent history. We're talking about Asa Elrup. We've talked about her in the past, who was married to Rex Heuermann for nearly 3 decades. It isn't exactly screaming conspiracy theory from the rooftops, but after finishing Gone Girls, the Long Island serial killer, that's out, it's on Netflix, right? Is it Netflix or is it Max?
Yeah, it's Netflix.
Okay. She's raising an eyebrow, maybe two. And honestly, when you dig into the history of corruption inside Suffolk County law enforcement, she might not be completely out of the line to ask, wait, what if?
Mm-hmm. I'll give her that.
I can see that. I can see it. Let's start with the dirty laundry, because Suffolk County has more than a few skeletons in its own closet. James Burke, the former police chief, is now best remembered for going full WWE on a suspect who had the audacity to steal a duffel bag filled with porn and sex tapes from his police-issued vehicle. No. Yeah. Burke beat the guy, tried to cover it up, and then got slapped with a 46-month prison sentence. Meanwhile, then-District Attorney Thomas Spada, instead of investigating Burke, allegedly helped sweep it all under the rug like you do. He was eventually indicted for obstruction, corruption, and witness tampering. All of this. The beatdown, the porn bag, the cover-up would be hilarious if it weren't so grotesquely real. LRIP's legal team is now asking a very real question. If this is how Suffolk County handled its own messes, how can we trust anything the case is against Tierman? Well, I can answer some of that. Because your husband wasn't investigated while they were there. It took them being kicked out for anyone to start looking into this more seriously. So I don't know that you really want to go down this road because, I mean, it may show some connections, maybe. I don't know. But I don't know that it really leads to he wasn't involved. That doesn't seem to be where a lot of this goes.
And don't forget, you've got the hair.
And her hair. On the bodies.
That's a big deal.
On a couple bodies. Yeah, that's kind of a big deal, too. Because, I mean, Richard Allen was convicted on a bullet that likely wasn't even from his gun. You got your DNA on a body. And your daughter's DNA on a body. And his DNA on a body. On separate bodies. On separate places. On separate occasions. What are the
odds
there?
And a weird spreadsheet of activities to do after done things to people.
Yeah, let's not get started on a spreadsheet of activities. That's a whole other thing. So, awesome. You seem like a smart woman. Kind of. Who divorced Tierman not long after his arrest is reportedly keeping a close eye on his court proceedings, including the ongoing Frye hearing, which could determine whether the DNA against him even makes it to trial. At the heart of the debate is a forensic method called whole genome sequencing, which sounds like something out of CSI, Space Edition. The defense calls it magic. Prosecutors call it science. Dr. Kelly Harris, a highly respected geneticist from the University of Washington, spent an entire day testifying about how the process works and why it's legit. In layman's terms, it's a super detailed way of matching DNA. And in this case, hairs found on the victims reportedly tie back to Hierman or people close to him, like Elrip or her children. Prosecutors claim these hairs were recovered from the remains or crime scenes of 6 of the 7 victims. That's not small stuff. It could be the linchpin of the entire case, but again, the defense is arguing that this method has never been tested in New York courtrooms and shouldn't be trusted until it's vetted through the proper legal channels. Well, guess what? Technology evolves. You get new things, and some cases are going to have to start using it. It's been vetted. Just because it's not seen a courtroom in New York yet doesn't mean it's not legit. And just because it's coming in on your trial doesn't mean you can say it's not fair, it's not right. I get it. You're an attorney. You're going to argue that. But it doesn't mean it's like, hey, Billy came up with this down the hall. He thinks it's real. No, not that. A brief rewind on the horror show that is the Gilgo Beach murders. From 93 to 2011, a string of women, most of them sex workers, vanished after meeting clients. Their bodies were eventually found dumped in remote spots along Ocean Parkway. Some were bound, some were dismembered, some were discovered in pieces, scattered between different sites. It was like Long Island's own version of a true crime nightmare. Here I'm in a 61-year-old architect who looked more like a guy you'd call to fix your kitchen backsplash than a suspect serial killer, was arrested in July of 23. He's been charged with the murders of 7 women so far: Amber Costello, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Sandra Costello, Jessica Taylor, and Valerie Mack. He's pled not guilty to every single one. And in a move that feels more like a legal strategy than desperation, his defense is now asking the court to split the case into 5 separate trials. Suffolk County's DA office insists there's no evidence the Hierman family was involved. They were reportedly out of town during the alleged murders, but proximity and DNA are still in the spotlight. And then there's Netflix, adding fuel to the fire with Gone Girls, directed by Liz Garbus, who also made Lost Girls, based on the 2013 book by Robert Kolker. The series shifts focus from the killer to the victims, their families, their stories, and how the system reportedly failed them. It doesn't exactly paint Suffolk County in a golden glow. Quite the opposite. As for Elrip, it was enough to make her question whether her ex-husband was being thrown under the bus by a system with a very shaky track record, allegedly. She's not denying the tragedy of the crimes. Her attorneys made it clear she extends her sympathies to the victims' families, but she also wants justice to be rooted in truth, not corruption, not cover-up, and not convenience. For someone who shared a home, children, and a life with the accused, it's personal. Whether Huerman is a monster hiding behind a suburban life or just a man caught in a very dark chapter of county corruption remains to be seen. But the courtroom drama is far from over. The judge still has to decide on the DNA evidence. And if you ask Asa Elrup, that decision just might decide everything. It might. It really, I mean, if they don't get that DNA in, he'll go down on other things.
I mentioned, and I keep mentioning it, every time we bring up Huerman, my mind goes to his basement and the things that they found in the basement.
Yeah, like his litany of child porn.
and
violent.
Concerning.
Yeah, all violent in all its nature and all that. Yeah, that might be an issue. The fact that they, you know, well, if you're going to go down the conspiracy road, you're going to say that everything in here is made up, that they planted the the to-do list or the how-to list or whatever the hell that was, that they planted the hairs, you know, all in effort to frame Rex Huerman of all people. Now, at some point, you just did it. If you got that much stuff in your house, or you're very, very disturbed and your proclivities towards death and sex and murderers are really, really disturbing and messed up.
If that's what you're into, then you take a look at the victims. The victims fit that profile.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say we keep the DNA out. There, I mean, was it Shannon? I can't remember.
Gilbert?
Forgive me. Yes. Wasn't she the one who described him as like an ogre?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a physical description that basically fits this man.
Yeah.
And his weird stalking of one of his, maybe an assistant or secretary or something when she was on a cruise. I mean, this guy is a creep.
I have no idea if Asa Elrup knew anything of what the hell was going on here. I'm not saying she's involved in the murders. I don't think she was involved in the murders. I do want to know what she knew. I do want to know what she saw. I want to know what was life like being married to this man for 3 decades? And did you see signs that you just didn't recognize at the time? Or were you, was it cognitive dissonance? Were you too close to it? Were you compartmentalizing things? What the hell was going on? And how do you have absolutely no idea that this man is, at the very least, very active with sex workers on a regular basis? At the very least.
I think she's the boiled frog.
Or did she? Was she aware? I mean, again, and if you're aware that your husband is out with sex workers, I guess sex work is technically a crime in New York, but I guess it's you are not committing a crime by being aware of that. I don't know why anyone would want to be in a marriage with someone who's like this. But everybody,
maybe it's all she knew.
Everybody has their own things. So, I mean, again, not a crime to condone, or, and I'm not saying she condoned it, or just being aware of what he was up to. Not necessarily that he was up to murdering people. But I guess there's a level of not wanting to be fully aware of everything too, that some people get into. You know, some people literally have spaces in their homes where like their spouse just cannot go, does not go. And it's like strict. That to me is insane, but that's how some people live.
Yeah.
So
I know several people like that. Like you don't go into my man cave. You just don't go there.
That's weird. What do you have in there that you don't go in there? Seriously, what do you have in there that you don't go in there, that you couldn't go in to the man cave portion of the house? What the hell do you have in there?
It's a valid question.
There should never be a valid reason for that in a marriage, in a shared house, that one party cannot go into another part of it.
Well, that's to insane. Me, that just screams that there's something huge missing and you're just ignoring the huge red flag in front of you.
Completely.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing.
That shit's not working and you need to escape from your spouse.
I'd be very concerned if my spouse, for any reason, said, you cannot go into this part of the house. You cannot. Yeah. I mean, I have no problem with privacy where it's like, you know, you don't look through each other's phones. I think that gets into territory. If you're feeling you need to do that, there's issues. I don't think it's not a healthy relationship if, for the sake of the relationship, you're checking through each other's phones and paging through everything. I think there's a level of privacy there that is fine if you trust the other person and things are good. It's never a solution, I think, to go, well, now we're going to check each other's phones just to make sure. That's extremely insecure behavior. It's controlling behavior, if you look at it that way as well. And I don't know that it's ever really justified. And not to say that the other person couldn't be doing something horrible, but if you're at that point, you probably shouldn't be in that relationship.
Yep.
Because spying on the other or doing random checks on things like you're the parole officer of your spouse is not going to fix your relationship.
No.
But to not go into a room.
Well, a lot of people are in denial and just it's easier to sit where they are than to go, you know what, the situation is not working. They've got a man cave or whatever that room is that I'm not allowed to go into.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's not healthy.
A lot of people who live in denial.
Yeah.
And the status quo, they would rather, you know, their bank accounts remain where they are than have to take the hit and get into a situation where they feel free.
And what kind of weird control is that too? Of you can't go into this part of the house.
Yeah.
Again, what are you hiding in that part of the house? I mean, what the hell are you doing that the other person couldn't go in there? I don't see any reasonable explanation.
Especially if you inhabit the same house, the same
address. Because guess what? If they're doing something illegal, you're also on the line too.
Yeah, you are.
So you might want to be aware of what's going on in your house. And there is no valid reason ever to not allow that to happen. Unless you're doing something really, really bad. Or you're afraid that they're going to get mad at you for whatever. And then that's not healthy either.
Yep.
It's not a healthy relationship if that is what's going on in anyone's relationship at all.
There's a lot of unhealthy relationships out there.
Oh, yeah. Because I think, I mean, it goes, if you're doing that, it goes beyond, oh, he's looking at porn on the computer. If you can't go in there, then erase your history. If you're just looking at regular old porn that's not child or illegal or something horrible. What are you so concerned with somebody finding that?
Most of it's on your phone now. It's not even on your computer, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the phone's portable. It's not a room. So what is happening in your man cave that you don't want your wife to see?
Well, I mean, look at that case out of Kansas City where the guys, like, they were all like my age, like early 40s or late 30s, and they go over to their friend's house to watch a Chiefs game, and then they go in the backyard after they did what they thought was cocaine, but it was laced with fentanyl, and they die in the backyard. And the owner of the house doesn't even know about it. And I don't know if there was a wife. I do not know the answer to that question. But if you got shit like that going down in your house and you got, like, hubby's got cocaine and he doesn't know it's laced with fentanyl, or he has cocaine in general in your house that you share children with, you probably should know about that. And you should probably both be on the same page. If hubby's going down to the man cave and he's snorting coke, you should probably be okay with that if that's how you want to live your life. That shouldn't be a secret. It just shouldn't be going on in general, really, if you're a healthy person. But, if that's your setup and you're all on the same page, like, you don't do that, but I want to do this, and we're going on here, and like, okay. But again, you also have to think of your own liability. This is happening in your house. You also can be in trouble for that, for being in possession of that. Again, there is no viable answer to this. I'm curious, anybody in the comments that wants to argue this and tell me how this is ever a valid idea or reason, I'm all ears, because I just don't see any reason why it would be in a healthy relationship.
Well, and I think the key word there is healthy. I think there's probably ever since the pandemic and quarantine and things like that, I think there's a lot of relationships out there. And I'm just speaking off the cuff here. I'm not a professional, but I feel like there's a lot of relationships that deteriorated and people are just going through the motions now. It's just, you know, they looked at their finances. They looked at living situations. It's just...
people are stuck.
Yeah, people are stuck and they don't know what the fuck to do. And they look at their retirement accounts and all of their bank accounts and go, I'm going to lose everything if I leave this situation. So I would rather stay here, be miserable.
And put up with that sort of demand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the price of things right now is so high that I think a lot of people are just like, I can't take that hit. You know, they feel trapped. They're cornered. It's easier to exist where you are.
Yeah, but it's not.
Than to do anything.
At the end of the day, it's not. What's worse than spending another day in a toxic, abusive relationship? Spending another day in a toxic, abusive relationship. That's the worst thing. And people keep going down that path over and over. The best thing is to get out, no matter what.
It's
difficult. It's difficult. I know it is. But, you can also end up in this situation. Or you can end up dead. That happens a lot, too.
Imagine it does.
Or your kids are subjected to this insanity. And then they grow up and think, oh, this is normal. Daddy can hide anything he wants from mom.
Right.
And if they're little boys, then they get into a relationship later. Well, dad did it. This is totally your friend. Fine. Little girls? Well, dad did it to mom, so I'm totally cool if my husband sets up a rule like that. That seems normal.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. You're also demonstrating toxic behaviors to your children, which will then repeat those cycles. And God knows what will happen to them. So,
oh, and you're allowing toxic behavior to yourself, too.
That, too. Yeah. Yeah. It's
a lot.
It's one of those where it's just a kind of big, take a big glass of wake the F up because you need to. And I don't think Asa, you know, took that sip until it was way too late. I want to see the Fitty documentary that's coming out on this, on Peacock. Still no word on when that's going to happen, but we know she got paid for it. So what's she going to say in it? I don't know. I'm guessing they're going to wait closer to trial to drop that when it's a little more top of mind. Once these other cases die down and that one comes up, it'll be very fascinating.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is a true crime in real time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Imagine sitting in a quiet, sterile room, the kind that police investigators know all too well, staring at a computer screen filled with ordinary digital clutter. Family photos, business emails, and files you'd find on anyone's laptop. Nothing unusual there. Until, out of that everyday mess, you stumble onto something chilling. Something you can't unsee. Something that feels like finding a serial killer's playbook just sitting there, staring back at you. That's exactly what happened in early 2023 when forensic investigators finally accessed the hard drive belonging to Rex Huerman. By now, you've probably heard his name splashed across headlines as the prime suspect in the Gilgo Beach murders, a string of horrifying killings that have haunted Long Island since remains were first discovered over a decade ago. But investigators weren't prepared for what they would uncover deep in Huerman's digital shadows, a carefully constructed, meticulously detailed, alleged manifesto deleted long ago, but now glaring at them in clear, stark text. What exactly was this document, this alleged blueprint of murder? Well, imagine a shopping list crossed with a DIY home renovation guide. But instead of paint colors and lumber, the items listed were ropes, tarps, acid, cutting tools, plastic bags, and cat litter.
And instead of casual weekend chores, this DIY guide detailed steps like building a table. Presumably, not for a friendly dinner party. It's as if Martha Stewart turned malevolent and started writing how-tos for hiding bodies and covering your tracks. Dark, I know, but disturbingly accurate. The document wasn't just a vague sketch or a creepy diary entry. No, it was methodical, almost military in precision, organized into clear stages labeled pre-prep, prep, and post-event. It spelled out exactly what needed to happen before, during, and after the horrifying acts. Each phase contained tasks you might expect from someone trying desperately to leave zero trace behind. It was a roadmap for evading capture, as chillingly detailed as instructions for assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, albeit a far more sinister piece. Let's break it down a bit. The manifesto contained its own coded shorthand, cryptic to outsiders but clearly defined by the author. DS1 and DS2 were not random letters and numbers. They stood for Dump Site 1 and Dump Site 2. These weren't just vague possibilities either. They pointed directly to specific locations, including an eerily accurate mention of Mill Road in Manorville, an isolated stretch of land on Long Island. It's a location where, years later, partial remains of known victims, Jessica Taylor and Valerie Mack, were found. It's unsettling, but it makes you wonder if the person writing this was quietly marking a spot on their macabre treasure map long before authorities ever arrived. Another shorthand entry, T-1, referred explicitly to targets, the victims themselves, human beings reduced to mere labels in this grim outline. Names and details were sparse, but one chilling note stood out clearly. Megan? Followed by a question mark. Investigators were left wondering if this referred directly to Megan Waterman, one of the known Gilgo Beach victims. Or was it just a coincidence, a placeholder of sorts? That's the disturbing part. It's like reading someone's notes, uncertain if you're witnessing their cold method of depersonalizing victims or catching a glimpse of confusion amid monstrous intent. Now, alongside these logistical codes were deeply unsettling checklists, practical measures for forensic countermeasures. This wasn't an amateur's rough sketch. It was an exhaustive list to avoid leaving evidence behind. Imagine the sort of precautions you'd take if you spilled red wine on your mother-in-law's prized carpet and multiply it exponentially. DNA avoidance? Check. The document recommended using booties, those little plastic shoe covers, to avoid leaving footprints or DNA, hairnets to prevent stray hairs from falling, surgical gloves to eliminate fingerprints, and then burning those gloves after use to destroy even the slightest trace of physical evidence. This wasn't casual caution. It was obsessive attention to detail. The steps didn't end there. There were instructions on how to remove identifying marks from victims, tattoos, birthmarks, scars, even fingerprints, and disturbingly practical advice on dismemberment and disposal, tools needed, how to package remains for discreet transport, and even notes about washing the victims to erase trace evidence. It's one thing to imagine such horrors. It's entirely another to realize someone meticulously typed them out on a computer, carefully crafted, and then consciously deleted, thinking no one would ever find them again. Also included were precise steps for surveillance, or recon, as the author called it, scouting locations, checking for security cameras, avoiding high traffic areas, using police scanners to monitor law enforcement chatter. This wasn't just paranoia. It was calculated strategy. Imagine a chess game, except the stakes aren't wooden pieces on a board, but life and death. The author of this document was carefully considering every possible scenario, every conceivable way to get caught, and proactively blocking those avenues. But among all these disturbingly specific tactics, there were terms drawn from criminal profiling literature. Phrases such as organized versus disorganized, Stockholm syndrome, and something called sex substitution. Let me unpack those briefly, because these aren't terms the average person throws around casually. Organized versus disorganized refers to how criminals behave. Organized offenders plan meticulously, while disorganized ones act impulsively. Clearly, the writer of this document was striving for complete organization. Stockholm Syndrome, a psychological phenomenon where victims bond with their captors, was noted down too, perhaps suggesting the author considered using psychological manipulation to extend control. And sex substitution, as clinical and detached as it sounds, implied methods of sexual assault that avoid leaving trace DNA, a horrifyingly practical consideration from someone intent on escaping justice. The author also made bizarre and troubling notes about maintaining control, suggesting that noise control was essential because sound travels, adding surreal and almost mundane advice like getting enough sleep beforehand, because fatigue could lead to mistakes. Think about that for a moment. Someone concerned enough with their performance that they worried about getting proper rest, like an athlete prepping for a big game, only here the game is unspeakable. One strikingly disturbing reminder in the notes said, "The more you do, the more clues you give." It's almost philosophical if you don't think too deeply about what doing means in this context. Another cryptic suggestion read, "Look at the painting, what, why, who?" Advice seemingly pulled from criminal profiling books, indicating an author trying to understand his own motivations or how investigators might analyze him. Imagine a serial killer studying the methods of law enforcement profilers, not to evade them randomly, but to deliberately preempt their investigative techniques. That's the unsettling level of foresight and calculation embedded in this document. It's crucial at this point to remind ourselves why investigators and prosecutors see this alleged manifesto as such a critical piece of the puzzle. Finding a detailed murder guide authored allegedly by the prime suspect in a string of brutal killings isn't just rare, it's practically unheard of. Most killers leave clues unintentionally. They slip up, leave behind hairs, fibers, fingerprints, or tire marks. They make mistakes. But very rarely do they leave behind a literal manual detailing exactly how they intended to avoid those mistakes. Think about what that means for investigators. It's like catching someone holding the murder weapon, fingerprints and all, after they've claimed innocence. This document could serve as a cornerstone piece of evidence, something prosecutors could point to and say, "Look, he planned this. It wasn't accidental. It wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't a misunderstanding. It was meticulous, cold-blooded intent." What's truly shocking is not just that this document was created, but when. Investigators estimate it was originally written around 2000 or 2001, years before many of the known Gilgo Beach victims went missing or were even discovered. That means whoever wrote this manifesto wasn't simply reflecting on past crimes. They were planning future ones. They had already envisioned in clear and explicit detail acts they were yet to commit. It's chilling to realize the planning was in place long before anyone realized a predator might be lurking. So why delete something so carefully constructed? Perhaps panic, perhaps fear of discovery, or maybe a realization that such explicit planning was too incriminating. The point is, this wasn't some proud trophy displayed openly. It was carefully hidden and erased, suggesting the author fully understood the gravity and guilt associated with its contents. As investigators pored over this document, matching its chillingly specific instructions to known evidence, victims, and crime scenes, they realized they had more than just a digital curiosity. They had what might be the strongest possible link yet in a long, complicated, and horrifying case. But just having a plan on paper doesn't automatically prove guilt, especially in a court of law where evidence must be airtight. And that's where things get even more complicated. Because matching words to reality, intentions to actions, is never as simple as it sounds, but the details, the sheer weight of what's written and what was done, make ignoring this alleged manifesto impossible. So where exactly does this newly revealed document fit into the puzzle investigators have been trying to solve for years? How does something created over two decades ago help unravel one of America's darkest mysteries today? Picture this. You're standing at the back of a crowded press conference, microphones shoved forward, camera shutters clicking like frantic crickets waiting for a district attorney to drop a bombshell. That's exactly what happened on a chilly winter afternoon. In early 2024, when Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney stepped confidently up to the podium. There was tension, curiosity, everyone knowing something big was about to be announced. Then calmly but forcefully, Tierney laid out new murder charges against Rex Huerman. It wasn't just another small update in an endless investigation. This was huge. Two new names, Jessica Taylor and Sandra Castilla, were now officially tied to Huerman, plus Valerie Mack. Suddenly, the Gilgo Beach investigation ballooned, linking murders spread over nearly two decades. But this announcement wasn't just shocking because of the names added. It was shocking because of how closely these new charges aligned with a dark, chilling document allegedly found hidden deep in Huerman's computer. We've already explored what that manifesto said, but now let's look at exactly how its cold, clinical instructions matched what investigators actually found at crime scenes. Piece by meticulous piece, since the manifesto author clearly favored smaller targets, victims who would be easier to overpower, control, and transport, and the grim reality matches perfectly. All of the known victims connected with Rex Huerman, Amber Lynn Costello, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Jessica Taylor, Sandra Castilla, and Valerie Mack fit a disturbingly similar physical profile. Petite, young women, most barely taller than 5 feet. It's not coincidence or guesswork. It's the exact victim profile described explicitly in the alleged notes. Even more unsettlingly precise was the instruction to remove identifying marks from victims' bodies. The author wrote plainly about eliminating tattoos, birthmarks, and scars, any feature that could quickly identify who the victim was. And tragically, this matches the state in which Jessica Taylor's remains were discovered back in 2003. Her killer didn't just dismember her, he deliberately mutilated a distinctive tattoo on her body, attempting to literally erase who she was. This kind of detail doesn't just happen by chance or panic. It happens when someone is deliberately following a methodical playbook. Valerie Mack, too, was treated with similarly calculated brutality. Her remains, found in two separate locations years apart, were carefully dismembered, head and hands removed to conceal her identity. It's exactly what the manifesto prescribed: removal of hands and head to eliminate fingerprints, dental records, and facial recognition. The echoes here are horrifyingly precise, down to the exact steps listed: remove, dismember, discard. It's as if the author was following a recipe, each victim becoming a grim ingredient in a monstrous plan. But it's not just the handling of victims themselves that aligns so disturbingly with the manifesto. It's also the actual physical evidence investigators uncovered at Rex Huerman's home. After carefully following the roadmap laid out in the alleged notes, remember the instructions we talked about earlier? Specific advice to hang plastic drop cloths from the ceiling using push pins rather than tape, presumably to avoid noise or sticky residue. Investigators following these clues returned to Huerman's basement with forensic precision, examining walls and ceilings with specialized infrared equipment. What they found were tiny pinholes punctuating the ceiling. The unmistakable marks left behind by pins, exactly as the manifesto described. It's the kind of detail you'd only find if someone was meticulously following their own gruesome instructions, not simply improvising. And let's talk about DNA, or rather, the stunning lack of it. Serial killers often leave behind inadvertent clues, hair strands, skin cells, fingerprints. Yet in many of the Gilgo Beach cases, investigators noted an almost baffling absence of clear, identifiable DNA from the perpetrator. The manifesto, of course, provided explicit instructions for precisely how to avoid leaving any DNA behind. Wear hair nets, medical gloves, and disposable booties. Wash victims thoroughly before disposal. Burn gloves after use. Investigators have acknowledged that the sparse forensic evidence from these crime scenes matches the manifesto's detailed instructions for avoiding detection. It's almost like the author anticipated every forensic method detectives would use and actively countered them. Another disturbing alignment involves vehicle and tire tracks, or notably, the lack of distinctive tire tracks at the crime scenes. Investigators knew early on that the killer likely used a vehicle for transport, yet they struggled to identify clear tire impressions or distinctive markings. Then came the discovery of notes in the manifesto urging caution with vehicles, advising to change tires frequently to avoid leaving consistent tracks. And indeed, during their investigation, detectives discovered that Huerman had multiple vehicles registered to him, including two nearly identical Chevrolet Avalanche trucks purchased at separate times. It fits precisely with someone deliberately swapping vehicles or tires to confuse investigators, another piece of advice spelled out in chilling detail. Now, perhaps the clearest and most haunting alignment of all is tied directly to a location mentioned explicitly in the manifesto, Mill Road in Manorville. This wasn't some random guess scribbled down. It was deliberately highlighted as a dump site labeled clearly as DS1. And years after this document was supposedly written, the partial remains of Jessica Taylor and Valerie Mack were indeed discovered near Mill Road. Let that sink in. A location identified by the manifesto author nearly two decades ago turned out to be exactly where victims' remains were later found. It's hard to dismiss such an explicit connection as mere coincidence or random luck, especially given the detailed care behind the rest of the notes. Yet even with all these eerie connections, it's crucial to remain grounded in the facts. Investigators carefully documented each alignment, each subtle but precise echo between the words on the computer screen and real-world crime scenes. They meticulously cataloged physical evidence at Huerman's home. Pinholes from pushpins in the basement, signs of structural alterations, and carefully cleaned surfaces as though someone had followed instructions to the letter. No speculation or guesswork, just painstaking forensic diligence. And it's this meticulous alignment between plan and reality, between the alleged manifesto and actual crimes, that gives prosecutors their strongest circumstantial evidence. Imagine trying to claim innocence when the details of your supposed fictional notes keep turning up again and again at real-world crime scenes. It's the equivalent of finding someone's secret recipe book, then discovering every ingredient from that recipe used exactly at the scene of multiple crimes. Coincidence only goes so far. Eventually, patterns become undeniable. As prosecutors build their case against Rex Huerman, this meticulous alignment between instructions and evidence isn't simply a minor detail. It's foundational. The lack of perpetrator DNA aligns exactly with methods explicitly detailed to prevent it. The dismemberments and mutilations mirror the step-by-step instructions written years before the crimes were even discovered. Even something as seemingly trivial as tiny pinholes in a basement ceiling offers a stark, chilling parallel. Another dot connected in a horrifying constellation of evidence. When District Attorney Ray Tierney stood in front of that crowded room announcing new charges against Huerman, he wasn't merely presenting disconnected allegations. Instead, he laid out an intricate tapestry of evidence, carefully woven threads connecting words written in secret to brutal crimes committed in darkness. These weren't casual similarities. They were disturbingly precise matches. Each one carefully documented, each one methodically investigated. But here's the tricky thing about circumstantial evidence. Even when it aligns this tightly, it's still not a direct confession or DNA match. It doesn't speak for itself. It has to be explained, interpreted, and argued in court. Prosecutors must convince a jury not just of the eerie alignments themselves, but of what these alignments undeniably imply. They must carefully unpack how precisely and deliberately reality matched the alleged manifesto, showing not just random chance, but meticulous, calculated planning that could only belong to someone directly involved. Which naturally leads us to the question, how exactly will prosecutors leverage this disturbing alignment between the manifesto and real-world evidence in court? How will they navigate the complex legal challenges of turning a haunting but circumstantial roadmap into undeniable proof of guilt? Imagine yourself in a courtroom, not the kind you've seen on TV, filled with dramatic lawyers pounding fists and witnesses breaking down under pressure, but a real one, quiet, tense, filled mostly with silent anticipation. Lawyers, investigators, jurors, all waiting to hear one thing: proof. Hard, convincing evidence that the person sitting at the defendant's table is undeniably responsible for terrible acts. In a case like the one against Rex Huerman, it's not enough to present a disturbing story or suspicious coincidences. Prosecutors have to show beyond any reasonable doubt not just that crimes were committed, but that this specific person planned them, executed them, and knew exactly what he was doing every step of the way. And that's where the alleged manifesto comes in. When Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney first described this disturbing document publicly, he referred to it as more than just a creepy digital find. It was critical evidence, tangible proof of premeditation. Premeditation is a fancy legal word, but at its core, it means someone thought about a crime before committing it. Not just briefly, but deliberately in detail and with clear intent. Think of it this way. The difference between an impulsive decision and carefully writing out a plan is vast in a courtroom. And here, prosecutors believe they found precisely that, a premeditated roadmap. But prosecutors have to tread carefully. Introducing evidence like this manifesto isn't as simple as tossing it onto a table and saying, "Here, look at how bad this looks." Legally, they have to demonstrate why this specific piece of evidence is critical, why it should be shown to a jury, why it helps prove guilt rather than just inflame emotions. You see, evidence in court must always pass the test of being more probative than prejudicial. That means its value for proving guilt has to outweigh any potential bias or unfair prejudice it might cause. Lawyers often fight fiercely over this issue, and you can bet Huerman's defense team will argue aggressively that this alleged manifesto is too prejudicial, that it will unfairly inflame jurors against their client. But the prosecution has a solid, straightforward argument. Yes, this manifesto is disturbing, but it's disturbing precisely because it aligns with what actually happened. It's not just a random graphic fantasy or fictional narrative. It's a document that matches real-world evidence and actions. Prosecutors will emphasize how it provides essential context, a clear demonstration of specific intent. The fact that someone thought these horrific acts through methodically, outlined steps meticulously, and then took deliberate actions to hide the evidence of wrongdoing. Another significant legal point prosecutors can emphasize is what lawyers call consciousness of guilt. The idea is simple. Innocent people generally don't go out of their way to hide or destroy evidence. If you've done nothing wrong, you typically don't feel compelled to erase every trace of your actions or delete detailed documents about committing crimes. Here, the prosecution will point out something very important. The manifesto itself wasn't found in an easily accessible place. It had been deliberately deleted from Huerman's hard drive. It existed only as fragments of data recovered painstakingly by digital forensic specialists. This deletion, prosecutors will argue, wasn't accidental. It was deliberate, careful, and calculated. It demonstrated awareness, clear knowledge that this document was incriminating and that it must never see the light of day. But prosecutors face another challenge. How exactly do you connect this single piece of evidence to multiple separate crimes spanning nearly two decades? This isn't just one murder trial. It's several murders, each happening years apart, different victims, different locations. The manifesto, though, offers prosecutors a critical tool, legal leverage to tie all these separate murders together under one defendant. They'll argue that the document's existence and the specific steps described in it illustrate a clear modus operandi, a distinctive way of operating that binds multiple crimes together. It's the courtroom equivalent of finding a single fingerprint across multiple crime scenes. Jurors must understand why these crimes aren't random or separate, but rather systematically connected by a precise, detailed plan laid out years before the crimes took place. So yet, despite all this compelling circumstantial evidence, prosecutors know that jurors might still need help connecting the dots. The manifesto's details, while chilling, can also feel confusing, clinical, and even detached. Jurors aren't experts in criminal behavior, forensic methods, or criminal psychology. That's why, at this point in the trial, prosecutors often bring in expert witnesses to explain complex matters clearly and objectively. Criminal profiling experts, forensic psychologists, or experienced investigators can play a vital role here. These professionals won't speculate or guess. Instead, they'll carefully explain terms found within the manifesto, like organized versus disorganized offenders, which refers directly to how meticulously planned crimes indicate deliberate and intentional behavior. They'll unpack concepts like sex substitution, describing objectively what it means as a tactic of sexual violence that deliberately avoids leaving behind incriminating DNA evidence. Experts might also help jurors grasp terms like Stockholm syndrome, explaining it clinically, without speculation, to demonstrate the degree to which the author of this manifesto was considering psychological manipulation and control as part of his alleged plan. Such testimony isn't sensationalized drama, it's straightforward clarification. Jurors need context to understand exactly why this manifesto is significant. It's like when you take your car to a mechanic, someone knowledgeable who can clearly explain what the strange sound or blinking dashboard light means without making guesses. Similarly, these criminal profiling experts serve as neutral guides, walking the jury through complex concepts, clarifying facts without assumptions, and ensuring the manifesto's importance is clearly understood. And these experts can highlight another key aspect: adaptability. The manifesto suggests an offender who learned and adjusted tactics, not repeating mistakes, evolving methods to avoid detection. This isn't speculation. It's objectively evident from the document itself, which explicitly notes ways to avoid leaving behind forensic clues, instructions to change routines and equipment to prevent capture, and even advice on getting adequate rest to avoid mistakes. Again, prosecutors will rely on experts not to guess, but to clearly illustrate what these written instructions objectively indicate about the mindset and intent of the manifesto's author. This expert testimony also provides an important framework for prosecutors to reinforce their narrative about Rex Huerman. It moves the prosecution's case from abstract concepts into something tangible, understandable, and concrete. It helps jurors see clearly how the dots connect, not just within one case, but across multiple murders spanning decades. It helps jurors see exactly why the prosecution argues that only someone intimately familiar with these crimes could have created such a chillingly accurate document. But the manifesto's impact doesn't stop at the courtroom door. Investigators, upon discovering the document, immediately recognized its potential as a roadmap for further investigative steps. In early 2024, detectives used details from the manifesto as a literal guidebook for conducting follow-up searches at Huerman's home and other associated locations. These searches weren't random. They were methodically planned based explicitly on insights from the recovered notes. Forensic teams revisited areas specifically mentioned in the manifesto, such as the basement ceiling with pinhole evidence of pushpins. They re-examined storage spaces, flooring, and even drainage systems mentioned in the document, searching for physical corroboration of the instructions outlined in this digital blueprint. This careful and targeted reinvestigation illustrates another essential role the manifesto has played. It's given prosecutors and detectives fresh avenues to pursue tangible evidence. Not speculation, but specific, verifiable locations and steps that could yield physical proof. It turned what could have been a confusing or daunting search into something focused, actionable, and incredibly valuable. Ultimately, the manifesto's greatest legal strength lies precisely in this fact-based clarity. It isn't vague. It isn't abstract. It's meticulously detailed, objectively aligning with documented physical evidence and providing prosecutors with specific, concrete tools to argue guilt convincingly in court. It's a document so precise, so clear in its details and implications, that jurors who must remain objective and unbiased will find it nearly impossible to dismiss as coincidence or casual fiction. As this case moves toward trial, prosecutors know they have an extraordinary piece of evidence at their disposal, one that doesn't simply suggest guilt, but actively demonstrates planning, intent, and deliberate attempts to avoid capture. It gives them a clear narrative, powerful leverage, and substantial legal tools to secure justice. But courtroom battles are always unpredictable, especially in complex cases involving serial murder and intricate forensic evidence. The manifesto isn't a magic bullet. It's a tool that must be skillfully used, carefully argued, and compellingly presented. Prosecutors must convince a jury of ordinary citizens, people just like you and me, that this deeply disturbing document isn't just horrifying fiction, but an undeniable glimpse into a carefully concealed criminal reality. And when they step into that courtroom, they'll lean heavily on this evidence, knowing its rare power to transform complexity into clarity, knowing it might just be their strongest chance at finally delivering justice.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
Well, they said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio.
Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.